This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For nearly 20 years, North Carolina's rich literary tradition has been on display in the pages of the North Carolina Literary Review. It has celebrated the state's most beloved authors, nurtured the careers of budding writers, and brought notice to up-and-coming poets and artists. This summer, it published its 20th issue, marking the occasion with a lush, full-color edition and a focus on a theme near and dear to the hearts of many longtime contributors, environmental writing. As part of our occasional series, North Carolina Literary Lights, we've invited two of those longtime contributors to join us. James Applewhite is Professor Emeritus of English at Duke. He's the author of 11 poetry collections and was inducted into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame in 2008. And Bland Simpson is Keenan Professor of English and Creative Writing at UNC Chapel Hill, as well as a longtime member of the Red Clay Ramblers. And we're also joined by the editor of the North Carolina Literary Review. Margaret Bauer is Reeves Chair of Southern Literature at East Carolina University, which publishes the review. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Margaret, tell us about maybe we should step back, because this is a beautiful edition. I want to talk all about it, but 20 years of the Literary Review. Give us a little history, will you?
Keith Sparrow, who was not yet Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at East Carolina University, but was the president of the North Carolina Literary and Historical Association, it was his brainchild. And he wanted to bring it to ECU. And so he asked Alex Albright, my colleague in the English department, to start it. And Alex jokes about having in mind a kind of traditional journal look and maybe some pictures until Eva Roberts from the School of Art at ECU came and said, let me show you what it could be. And there, the first issue was born, and it was quite different from anything that you saw at that time.
Because it included so much artwork, photography.
Yes.
And this edition, as I say, is lovely. Tell us about the theme for this year and how you arrived at it, North Carolina environmental writing.
Well, people have suggested the theme for a while, and so we put it on the list. And then with the 20th issue coming up, I thought it was an appropriate theme. The first issue featured John Lawson, who, as one of North Carolina's earliest travel writers, wrote about the environment. So it seemed appropriate. Then last summer when the Appalachian issue was coming out, I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous because I wondered if the environment would appeal to a broad audience the way the Appalachian issue did. Until I saw those tar balls on TV rolling up the coast of my native Louisiana. And I said, I think it's time for an environment. I'm glad we're doing it.
Yeah, and it can be broadly interpreted. Much of the issue devoted to chronicling the North Carolina landscape, which, Bland Simpson, you have been doing for quite a while. What's the motivating force behind your work?
Well, one of them, Frank, was I grew up in Pasquotank County in the Northeast and then moved to Chapel Hill. And for many years, heard people from the central part of the state say, boy, I can't wait to get through all that flat country and get to that beautiful beach. There's nothing there. And there's plenty there, almost 200 miles between here and there. And it's a huge integrated estuarine system and tremendously rich in biodiversity of all sorts. And so I just wanted to help bring that kind of thing forward.
Well, biodiversity and integrated landscapes, I think, is really the tie that binds all of these themes together. Jim, I want to hear your poem in a moment, Driving from Columbia. But first, can I ask you to tell us about the poem?
Well, it came to me providentially, as it were. I'd been at Columbia in South Carolina, at a festival celebrating and mourning the passing of my old friend Jim Dickey, and I'd given him a couple of papers. And on the way back, my wife was with me. Somehow I just felt that my whole life was hovering above me and reeled out behind me as I drove, and the future in front of me. I started the poem on a Starbucks paper bag that I held on the hub of my... I mean, sometimes there's a sight that I see, and my imagination starts working.
And forgive me for interrupting, but do you work then simply with that image, or is it already integrated with those larger thoughts of your life unwinding and the future before you?
I think the ideas, the thoughts evolve from the image. you know, I saw this bare, blunt concrete warehouse on the edge of town that reminded me of the shop that my father used to have in a service station in the garage, that emptiness you talk about, you know, the emptiness which is in a strange way home for your spirit.
Will you read from your poem, and maybe you can set it up because we won't read the entire poem.
Yeah, well, this warehouse was so real and yet somehow unreal. Driving can seem sort of somnambulistic sometimes, and I experienced again that sense of all the actuality of the world is somehow very real but also dreamlike. And the small towns I was driving through were part of my past, and the Sunday schools, the churches, in a way, it seemed that at this moment, all these travels I'd made through that kind of terrain were generic. It was not just the one place, but all these similar places we drive through and drove through. Our story unwinding again across this rural level landscape, generically placing us among those people who've inscribed the landscape over time with their lives, their histories.
Will you read for us?
Sure. This is the second part. Radiant and whole and unknowable, this interface with fields that time threads out feels real and unreal, a material world, a space for years to cross as I trace the twists and turns with miles behind us. This present, I disbelieve, intersects a wild turkey's crow-black sheen across the road as my fate winds its skein again from home to rain. I find it still a glass half-silvered, like soul under soil, semi-transparent. My love rides beside, as my hands guide us over swale and hollow and river, the houses already dreaming at lamps at evening. This road-threaded land, hill-contorted, smoothed by streams, holds almost our whole life, as all the ways behind seem to wind again through time, as I see in the rearview mirror. Our story one of many, we travelers of the century we came from. Presently, I feel us in our last facing of west turn sundown golden in glare through the windshield. And though of houses left in the past behind, some wink out their windows, others reflect the leveling sun and prong their shine into the known, into the unknown, blindly lighted, traveling with us. Our headlights carve the coming dark.
James Applewhite reading from his poem Driving from Columbia. That was part two, part of the 20th anniversary edition, or the 20th edition of the North Carolina Literary Review. That poem, James, it seems to me, answers the question about whether, if you're writing environmental writing or anything, theme writing, whether it's didactic and somehow polemical. What you're saying there is that not that we have to vote yes on, you know, kill the dam. This is that our lives are integrated with the landscape, and that's the power of environmental writing, it seems to me.
Absolutely. It's something that occurs over time. We can't disavow our past. We're products of it. Some of the past was wrong. Your heart bleeds when you read of the logging of those Appalachian mountains early on. But now they've, thankfully, through the great gift of this cosmos and its resiliency, they've recovered, they're reforested, they can be the spirit's home for a poet.
Is that the, Bland, when you think about that, again, the integration, that's what you were talking about in that flat, you know, space between the triangle and the beach, that stuff you got to get past. It's realizing, recognizing your connection with it, and it seems to me that's part of your writing as well, not just describing, but, again, writing your story, inscribing it in a landscape that didn't really need you. It would have been there with or without you.
It'd be just fine without me. But I was fine with it, too.
You were fine with it. And it shaped your life. And we are who we are because of it. It's not something that we can, you know, just idly log and you know, sort of obliterate without somehow a part of our own lives.
Not at all.
being lost. So what goes on in your mind when you're writing these things? Is there a polemic? Is there a kind of an activist surge that runs through you when you're writing, or is it simply the landscape? What happens when you're writing this kind of work?
Well, it's simpler than that for me. I love. I grew up loving water and growing up on water and enjoying being around it and loving the swamps and that sort of thing. So I just like to be out in it, and I like enjoy the role of trying to describe these places in such a way. Both the spirit one feels when one's out in the great wide open, and telling that part of the tale.
Margaret, when you set up this theme, what were you expecting, and how did those expectations change as you began to gather the material?
Well, that's the fun part about NCLR is when we come up with a theme, we might have one thing in mind, and by the time it comes out, we can't remember what we had in mind. It evolves as the writers send me material. Last summer, the North Carolina Writers Conference was honoring Bland, and several of the writers who are in this issue were there, so I was able to go and talk to each of them. Because of the nature of Bland's writing, the nature of their writing was also focused on nature and the environment. And so I talked with Janet Lemke and Jan DeBlue and Bland and David Soselsky about submitting to this issue. And they all came through.
Bland, will you read for us some of your essay, Cacheye River Days?
Yes, sir. In January 1989, Ann and I went all over northeastern North Carolina on our honeymoon, John boating hither and yon on cold, sunny afternoons. We watched buzzards kettling on up into the Carolina blue yonder above the upper Pungo River marshes at Leechville, followed nutria on a mat of reeds floating in the upper Alligator north of Kilkenny Landing, and spooked huge great blue herons on a gunmetal gray morning up Spanish mossy Pembroke Creek on Edenton's west side. Not the way of it for all souls, perhaps, yet we thought it very good sport indeed. And we were very sporting about it, right down to the tying off of the metal boat atop the Subaru station wagon, usually at dusk, with yellow plastic rope that stiffened in the deep cold as we half-hitched our way to glory. Our last outing of that trip was on the Cacheye, well down the Lazy River from the Windsor Bridge. And though the afternoon was getting on, we still wanted to take a look at one more waterway before heading west to our upstate home. Down a sandy lane to the muddy, unimproved old landing we drove, and at its end I had just enough room to turn the car around. There was no ramp, just the river's shallows to put the boat in, and clearly no one, outside of a few duck hunters perhaps, had put in here for months. In a few minutes we were rigged and away upstream, where the river would narrow some, and we would come upon oxbows and cutoffs, wiggles and waggles with great gums and cypress and oaks overarching. Anne wore a white and gray knitted headdress we had found for her in Iceland, and I had on my father's old tan hunting hat. We were warm enough, and the winding stream beneath the cold slate-gray sky was all ours, and ours only. The resurrection fern, an air plant everywhere above us, just lay up there on the bigger branches, getting whatever it wanted from breeze and bark, able to turn brown and play dead, but with the slightest moisture, able to green right up again. Everywhere this January day, on the cypress, the oaks, and gum trees, the small feathery fronds were most of the green in sight, beyond the occasional holly and the John Boat's olive drab. There was something almost infatuating about a plant that vivid and colorful growing about and above us in the dimming winter woods, something that said, "Watch me, and follow me, and spring will come soon." The same promise one sees in a farm field after fall harvest, when its winter cover, its wheat or rye, is coming up and asserting itself as all around the year is dying. In the here and now of the wintry Cacheye, this fern seemed for us not only an omen of springs yet to come, but almost a promise, too, of a long and happy life. So ubiquitous was the resurrection fern on the Cacheye that one might have kept following colony after colony of it up and down these waters through the swamp woods as if it were all leading to revelation.
Bland Simpson reading from his essay Cacheye River Days as part of the 20th edition of the North Carolina Literary Review. And Bland, that's part of a book that you and your wife, Ann Carey Simpson, are writing.
Yes, Little Rivers and Waterway Tales.
Tell us about that book.
Well, a couple of years I'll be able to tell you more about it. there's a lot of floating rivers yet to do.
Yeah. Is that what you're doing? You're actually going up and down and navigating these rivers?
Not the big drains like the Neuse and the Pamlico and the Cape Fear, but smaller rivers like the Cacheye and the Lumber and the Meharry and so forth.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, because we didn't cover them in our previous two books.
it's all that's left. What's the point of a literary review? What's the value of this sort of thing, Margaret?
Well, I'd love to hear what they have to say about that. I will say my primary – well, a couple primary goals are introducing new North Carolina talent – people, when we have the opportunity to publish people like our stars who are here today, next to a writer you may not have heard of, someone may discover that writer because they came in to read James Applewhite's latest poetry or Bland's latest essay. So that's really exciting for us to introduce new writers and to reintroduce neglected writers. This most recent issue, Tom Douglas did an article on Richard McKenna, a Chapel Hill writer who's been maybe forgotten. And so those kinds of preserving our literary history.
Lots of great artwork and photographs. I'm going to get to this question in a minute, but you've got artwork and photographs. Romare Bearden is represented, Jacob Lawrence, Ann Carey Simpson, Ellen Gurganis, Daniel Wallace. Beautiful artwork and photography as well, and essays, historical and otherwise. But Jim Applewhite, the value of a literary review, literature, why do we need it?
Makes you aware that there is a community of writers in North Carolina who are world-class. They are articulating the experience of being in North Carolina for themselves, for their readers. But for them to be brought together like this gives me a great feeling of enthusiasm and hope that, you know, degradation of the landscape comes out of a degraded culture. And ultimately, the relation of the mind to the to nature is something that the culture has to internalize, the idea of the internal landscape matching or mirroring the external landscape. That's something that the developer doesn't feel. The developer lacks imagination. When we were talking about buying our lot next to the Eno River, he said, "I hear tell there might be a stream out back, but it won't bother you. I don't really know if it's out there." He says, "What I usually do is I cut it all down level to see what I've got." So that means to see what I've lost.
Yeah. Well, it's a kind of imagination, and I think that's it. There's something that the developer imagines, but it isn't the integration of human life with the
– It's what Coleridge called the cold, inanimate world allowed to the poor, loveless, ever-anxious crowd. It doesn't – you know, the landscape is fecund, intricate, a product of – a creation 13.7 billion years ago, which had exacting parameters so that we're here. It's, right. It's an expression of something wonderful about the universe.
And that's what literature does, doesn't it? It allows us to exercise that kind of imagination
yes.
to come up with, to get out of the polarity of left and right and conservative
right.
and
absolutely.
And liberal and understand third and fourth and fifth ways around these issues. Bland Simpson, why do we need another literary review? This better be good.
This state and all these lands, agricultural lands, natural lands, forest, waters, constitute our commonwealth. Hmm. And the literature, these poems and tales, anecdotes, essays, stories, are a reflection, an imaginative reflection, and in a way a kind of recurring dream that always has variations because there are these individual artists that go after that. That, too, is our commonwealth. And we, whether we're artists or editors, whatever we are in this, we learn from each other. And it's learning through language, image, and inspiration.
We thank you for sharing your abundance and wealth with us today. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Frank.
James Applewhite, Professor Emeritus of English at Duke, author of 11 poetry collections, inducted into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame in 2008. Bland Simpson is Keenan Professor of English and Creative Writing at UNC Chapel Hill, as well as a longtime member of the string band Red Clay Ramblers. And Margaret Bauer is the editor of the North Carolina Literary Review and Reeves Chair of Southern Literature at East Carolina University. You can order a copy of the 20th issue of the review at nclr.ecu.edu or pick one up at an independent bookstore somewhere near you. Coming up, a conversation with and music with Steely Dan sideman John Harrington. Stay tuned.